Okay, welcome to the Canadian Orange Podcast. As the inverse of the current Canadian political system, this is a place where well-informed, thoughtful people can have serious conversations about serious topics. If my audio is a little bit wonky today, I'm having some mic issues, so I'm not using as good of a mic. Maybe it won't be a big difference. Who knows? The Orange mission is to fix money so we can begin fixing Canada. My name's Nick. I'm talking to Lucas in this episode. And if this conversation resonates with you or offered you value, please consider sharing it with others or donating to the Canadian Orange Party to support the show. You can go to CanadianOrangeParty.com to do that. Current block height is 928304. Hash rate is 1,077 exahashes per second. And one Canadian dollar currently buys you 838 sats. So today we're going to share our cheat codes for personal finance. Small side note, if you haven't already, please visit endinflationcanada.com. Give us some feedback. We're working on pamphlets that are designed to expose the fraud of fiat currency. And I just want to toss this in there. I just remembered we're collecting feedback on that. And if that website resonates, share it with people that you know and love so they can escape fiat slavery. So, personal finance. I think health and money are two super important things that state schools or government schools teach virtually nothing about. What are your thoughts on that, Lucas? Do you agree? I don't think we need to necessarily get into the debate over whether you think that's an accident or on purpose. I think it's just about incentives, but would you say that's true? Like, do you remember learning anything about health and money when you went to school?
Yeah, briefly. In terms of health, it was all wrong for sure. Basically, it's the party line of doctors, which is usually like anywhere from 25 to 50 years old, the information. And there's all sorts of crazy financial incentives. That's a really cool rabbit hole to go down. It's pretty dark, but from such things as I don't know what the actual field of study was, but they basically were paid the equivalent of like the cost of a Toyota Camry to say that sugar was better than saturated fat, and they've probably been responsible for that act. They've probably been responsible for like tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of deaths and unhealth in everyone that you've ever seen, probably. That's a pretty hyperbolic claim. But anyway, so that's the kind of thing that your, you know, 25-year-old eighth grade teacher is telling you, that like, oh, you know what, sugar is actually not that bad, or these things. So health, obviously, I remember learning that inflation is necessary, just like teaching this kind of amateur Keynesian model for economics at some point in high school. I think it would have been social studies. They have this kind of they don't know really what they're talking about. They were taught this in university probably at some point, and they just kind of offloaded that. And so you grow up thinking on some level that inflation is okay. You don't really think about it too much. That's about it. But I don't attribute that to some grand design. I just think it's just people being wrong and trusting what they're told too readily.
Yeah.
What about you?
I mean, I don't remember learning anything accurate or meaningful that I still retain about health or money. Both those endeavors for me have been just self-directed. And like you said, I have vague memories of being taught things that were directly untrue. So it's like they teach you, not only do they not teach you anything of use, the stuff they teach you is worse than useless. Because you have to unlearn it, attempt to unlearn it and move beyond it in order to learn the truth. And I think what they taught was more this dry theoretical stuff. Like nothing was taught to me about the trade-offs of getting a mortgage, having a credit card, where you put your money, what is money, how does this whole thing work? So I think a lot of people, I know a lot of stories where people just get in bad debt because they had no understanding of how to navigate debt and to be careful with debt. So just super simple things. And I think even this notion that it's good to go tens or hundreds of thousand dollars into debt, to go to a place for 4 years to learn outdated information that's worse than useless, it's turned into a racket. Even education, which is all part of financial literacy or lack thereof. Like, now you can learn from the best people in the world online anytime for free. Why would you go into huge amounts of debt to learn information that's not even up to date? So I think sound money, fundamentally changes things, because when you reevaluate your money, you reevaluate everything in your life. And so I think what I'm trying to get at is they teach worse than useless stuff. Health and money are super important topics to live well, to live a good life. And, Lucas and I both have children. And so we decided to frame this conversation as basically us sharing what we would want our 16-year-old kids to know in order to prepare them really well to have, a good relationship with money. And we'll just stick to just sharing principles. I know a lot of people, and I myself have a family story that money caused a lot of turmoil in my family, or should I say misunderstanding money or misusing money created turmoil in my family, and sort of a really crap set of values that have had health consequences. So I won't go into more deeper than that, but I think a lot of people, maybe don't have clear relationships with money within families. I think it's a big cause of family friction. And it's essential information that our kids need to know. So, why don't we start with just any high level principles or heuristics or categories of things that you want your 16-year-old kids to know? And by the way, to our 16-year-old kids potentially listening to this very episode in, a varying amount of years from now, depending how old you are, thanks for listening and applying these principles. Your dads are doing their best to distill out the cheat codes.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that you learned about, like, getting a credit card or whatever was fine. I actually learned something that saved me a lot of trouble, but it was wrong. I thought that the 20% interest rate on my credit card applied monthly, and that I was going to be paying $200 a month. I had like a $1,000 credit card. It might have even been $500 to start. And so I would religiously pay it off every single month. I never had a debt. It wasn't until, like, to my embarrassment, it wasn't until like a few years ago that I learned this was not the case, and that it was over the course of a year. And I could actually feel myself relaxing into the idea of spending more money on my credit card because of this. Super, super fascinating, pretty silly, but...
I'll tell you something sillier. Yeah. I used to, if I go to a rugby game or if I go to a university event or sports event, they used to have credit card companies give you free stuff if you signed off for a credit card. And I used to do it so frequently. I'd just give them all my information, sign up for a credit card that I wouldn't activate, but someone could have intercepted and activated it. I'm just like, oh, a rugby shirt or like a cool, I don't know, notepad, or I don't even know what. It was obviously something that meant something to me more than the 10 minutes it would cost me. But I just remember how, looking back now, I'm like, they got me with just a little free gift.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And you're, like 18 years old or like,
Yeah. No, nothing. It's like free stuff. Yes, please. I'll take it. I'll take two.
Yeah. It's really challenging to distill. I'm sure you'll do a better job distilling things down into like concise knowledge. I think the key is understanding money. And that's not understanding the behaviors of money. That's not understanding debt necessarily. It's not understanding the stock market or understanding, like, all those things are good to know. Understanding what a mortgage is and all that. Like you, I had zero education in school about this, which makes me suspicious of the whole school enterprise to begin with. But, Yeah, I think that if you don't understand what money is and where it comes from, it's just you're, I don't know. It's I can't see it being possible to be able to navigate the world, the fiat world, in a way that's gonna provide value for you in the future and security in the future. And I think that another thing I'd say is that it's so much simpler as an individual, to like, you don't have to become an expert or work jobs that make you incredibly wealthy. It's provide value for people and save your money in Bitcoin and spend it if you can. Spend and replace it in Bitcoin if you can. That's kind of what I would seek the people that are using it. And yeah, that's kind of where I'm going right now. My brain's just chugging along here, but yeah.
I like it.
What are your thoughts on like the fundamental kind of principles of like what you would tell your 16-year-old self or son or daughter?
Well, what I found is there's so much complexity, and I think there's a lot of parallels between health and finance. Or I should say disease care and finance. So disease care has nothing to do with being healthy. It just has to do with diagnosing your problems, diagnosing your symptoms of your problems, and treating the symptom, but you never address the root cause. And I think finance is really all about trying to understand all this complex stuff that has to do with investing when you never actually address the root cause of the problem, which is if money breaks, everyone has to become an investor. But when we have sound money, investing is optional. And most people, frankly, shouldn't invest their money because it involves a lot of understanding, a lot of time and energy and motivation to truly understand what makes something worthwhile investing in, like a business or a company. Like, you have to understand security analysis. Otherwise, you're depending on what someone else tells you. And that's an easy way to lose money because they might be well-intentioned and tell you something that's not good, or they might tell you the wrong thing for the sake of making money. Either way, I think the four principles I always come back to in how I try and explain the process of building wealth and having financial health in your life is four principles. One is live a profitable life. So create more value, create more than you consume, or spend less than you make. These are all framings of the same principle, which is have a net surplus where you are creating more value in the world than you are consuming. A pragmatic way that people say is live according to your means, or live within your means. I think live below your means is actually a better saying. It's like, because live below your means means you're making more money than you're spending. So principle one, live a profitable life, create more than you consume. Principle number two is once you create more than you consume, you have a surplus that you have to decide what to do with. And that surplus is effectively your time. So you have you. It's like money is just a token to represent your time. If you give more value to the world gives you back some time, right? A time token. If you have a surplus of time tokens, you got to figure out how to store your time because there's a lot at stake. If you put your time into a form of currency that's constantly being devalued, your time is effectively continuously being stolen. So once you live a profitable life, you should study money to find out what is money, what makes good money and bad money, what kinds of money should I store my time in that will actually protect my time and preserve it, because that's a really important thing to know when you have extra. The third principle is save in sound money, aka just save in Bitcoin. Maybe there's a case that gold is still sound money. But just save in sound money, just to not say Bitcoin or gold only. Save in forms of money that can't just be created by a certain group of people with no cost. And then the fourth one, which is optional, is invest wisely if you have a desire to invest. And frankly, if you're not ready to invest, at least 2 hours a week studying and understanding the things you're investing in to make sure that they are and continue to be a good investment, you shouldn't invest. And the beauty is this framework is, this is a radical simplification of most people's current framework, which is usually, you know, living profitably isn't a huge deal anymore because people will take on tons of debt in order to get something that they can't currently afford, right? The reason you get a mortgage on a house, on a $1 million house, is because you can't afford to pay for a $1 million house. So you just spend from your future by taking on, the word mortgage, mort, M-O-R-T, means death in French. It's like death document in French. So it's like, there's a reason it's called that. It's because it's something you're going to sign on to probably be paying off for the rest of your life. You might sell your house and get rid of the mortgage at some point. But in this world, it's like, live way beyond your means is how it is right now. It's almost like these are the inverse of everything that's being done right now. I just realized this. Live a profitable life is the inverse is live well beyond your means. Study money, the inverse is don't study money, which most people do. Saving right now isn't done because if the money's broken, you get punished as a saver.
Well, the opposite of studying money is studying monopoly money, which is what most people do, like professionally. If they're going into an economic university or college, they're going to be studying fake fiat money and how, and like, not only are they just not learning about money, they're just like, they're studying lies.
So
it's,
yeah, exactly.
It's a funny kind of like, it is upside down.
You're literally counter studying because you're bringing yourself further away from truth. You're just consuming propaganda. You're just consuming lies. And then, yeah, the interesting thing is today, everyone has to be an investor because the money's broken. So you need to invest. You need to buy a house. You need to buy an investment property. You need to buy stocks. You need to take some risk. If you're a degenerate, you need to buy some meme coin token to try and make 100x because otherwise it's hopeless. Like, that's your only hope of getting forward in this world where a house costs so much more than you'll ever earn. People turn to basically gambling in, just like people go to the lottery that have very little money. So right now, all the incentives point to just financial dis-ease, frankly, and being in debt and being reliant on other people or other things for handouts, which is ironically the government. So anyway, to our kids listening to this, that was a bit too deep. Back to the principles. The four principles are literally make more money than you spend, study money, understand it, the principles of it. And the only things are, what are the functions of money? What are the properties of money that make a money good or bad? That's really all you have to know. And then you have an understanding from first principles of money. Save and sound money just means save your extra time in Bitcoin. And then invest wisely means make wise choices about where you want to take more risk to make more of a return. That's like the biggest difference with saving and investing. Saving means you're putting your time into a form of money that will just preserve it, right? It won't lose you money over time. It will just protect it and preserve it. Investing means you're taking a bit more risk in order to generate a higher reward than just saving that money. If you take an unwise risk, you lose the money. If you take a wise risk, you can generate a bigger return than you would if you just saved, because then you just have the same amount. So those are like the principles. And you know, we can dive deeper into each of those principles, but I'd love to know your thoughts on those principles, if they resonate, if there's anything to add, disagree with.
Yeah, I find now that I'm into understanding sound money and into Bitcoin, I find it's really hard to understand what makes a good investment. Like the opportunity cost in Bitcoin terms, I guess they call it the hurdle rate, I think, is so high. And I think part of that
definition of hurdle rate, I completely agree with you, but I think may not know what hurdle rate is. So just unpack that.
So most people invest in, let's say, an index fund like the S&P 500, which I think is about 8% growth rate per year.
Might be a bit more. Might be closer to 10.
Okay. Let's say it's 10. So basically, you put $100 into your S&P 500 brokerage account. Like, you buy $100 worth of S&P 500 on your brokerage account. At the end of the year, you have $108. And then, so let's imagine you just don't put anything into that. Another year, that $108 will increase by 10%. Or sorry, I'm sorry, 10, let's say $110.
I'm looking it
Good
up.
old
I mean, I
public
want to
math.
know.
You can tell I didn't go to university for economics, but
It's okay. I think, yeah, it's around, let's say it's around 13. I looked it up, 5-year
Oh,
compound.
cool.
Let's say 13.
Wow, what a steal. Okay. So you get $113 at the end of the year. At the end of the next year, let's say you stopped contributing to that amount of money, that $113 will compound by another 13%, or yeah, which I'm not going to calculate that. So that's the, I guess, I think you'd consider that a compound annual growth. There, you could devise or like calculate some compound annual growth rate from that, and just and out from there, the longer time in the market you have, the more money that's going to be worth. And the CAGR of Bitcoin, I don't know, it's a lot higher than 13%. And so
Closer to
it's
like
actually
40 to 50. Depends what time horizon you're looking at.
right. And so some of the best performing stocks in the world don't do that well. So you're saving in money and you're looking for something to put your money into so that it grows faster than, like, it becomes worth more than the money, but you can't find it, or it's very challenging to find. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like, I think that just saving in sound money and generally speaking, just not trying to be an investor playing, and that would drag me down the rabbit hole of how corrupt the stock market is and how awful of an institution the stock market is. So personally, I'm just like, for me, it's just buy Bitcoin and hold on to it, and but that's my take on that. It's I guess what I'm saying is I don't really know what to think of investing, even on a personal level. Like, am I going to be able to create a business that generates 40% growth per year? Potentially. Not at this point, but it's
It's tough. Only the best businesses will survive in a sound money world, which is frankly how it should be. Yeah, I think most people should just save. That's it. I think, again, if you want to devote time and energy, I don't think investing is going away. I think fiat money has tarnished equities. I mean, when they're printing gobs of money, it creates this really weird thing where the people who control the money control and can manipulate the stock market. So there's the way it's done right now is super unfair and broken. I also think there's this paradigm shift going on where Bitcoin is literally swallowing fiat stock markets. So MicroStrategy is like the first bridge. And I don't want to spend too much time going down the investing rabbit hole because maybe, I mean, we could talk about it in the future. To me, investing in a Bitcoin world, there's way less reason to do it. Way less of your capital needs to be invested when you can make 40% on Bitcoin. I think to me, investing is about supporting companies that are accelerating the demise of fiat. And I like being up to date on what companies are doing that. What companies are building the bridges in the fiat stock market to build into, they call it the legacy financial market. I call TradFi, traditional finance. BitFi is the new equity layer, stock layer that's going to develop. And as TradFi burns and dies, and people realize how corrupt and messed up it is, BitFi is going to emerge. There's still going to be people who want to own equity in great companies. Within a Bitcoin world, what matters less as someone who likes to understand investing in a Bitcoin world is how many Satoshis do I have exposure to for each share that I own in this company? So this company is doing something, they're delivering value with real products and services, they're saving their extra in Bitcoin just like a family would do. For every share that I own in that company, if that company is generating positive cash flows and putting it into Bitcoin, every share I own in that company is increasing in how many sats I own. And so if I save one sat, if I save 10,000 satoshis in cold storage. I will have 10,000 sats. That will be worth more relative to everything else, but I'll always have 10,000 sats. If I buy shares in a company and the total amount of sats I have title to with those shares, which again, that's a complexity too, because that's not owning Bitcoin. Me saying I own, you know, X amount of sats total based on these shares is not the same as me owning Bitcoin. They're very different trade-offs. But if I go to bed one night and I wake up the next night and a company sold a bunch of products and bought more Bitcoin and I own more sats per share that I own, that's generating me Bitcoin denominated returns for the risk I'm taking of putting money up to invest in that company. So I think it's way simpler, because what matters is the amount of sats owned per share of a company. And as long as that's true, what they claim is true, there's actually way less complexity required in the world of investing in this BitFi world, because I don't have to look at all their financial, I still have to understand the company, right? It's like, there's a few companies that I use, for example, that I think make great products and services. If I can support those companies, if I believe they're doing things right in alignment with Team Human, and they're making great products and services and making my life better, they might be able to do it for more other people. And if they're saving their extra in Bitcoin, I can support a good team that can also generate more Bitcoin than I would have by just saving it in cold storage. The one caveat there is you need to have a lot of bandwidth, time, and desire to learn or current expertise on how to evaluate whether something's a good investment or not, because it's really complex. Even just a home, if you want to buy an investment or an investment property, like a condo, for example, right now, there are so many variables packed into doing that. Even down, like, the small things are like, how do you navigate taxes? How do you find the right tenant? How do you make sure they're going to pay you? How do you navigate repairs? How do you navigate condo fees? How do you navigate condo politics? You know, like,
what are your rights as a property owner? Yeah.
What are your rights? How does insurance work? Do you have to insure it? Who's liable for what? Like, there's just so many, like, if they want to build the train station through where your property is, does that just get jacked from you? If there is a natural disaster and your building goes down, like, what? Like, there's just so many variables. And so I think investing, the cumbersomeness of investing, literally, it's so cumbersome and complex. People pay money managers to invest for them. This is the goofiness of it, right? Investing has become so complex. It's mandatory, because this is in the fiat world. My money is melting. Investing is mandatory unless I want to get really poor really quickly. So I need to do something. I don't know what to do. So I'm going to pay a money manager to manage a stock portfolio for me and hope that I don't get wiped out in a, you know, every 10 years there's a wipeout. It's like, yeah, people call the S&P the risk-free rate because you can do basically nothing and make 13%. But there's periods in time where it wasn't so risk-free, right? Where it literally took you 5 years just to get back to even because there was a giant washout of nonsense in the financial system, right? Like 2000, 2008, the Great Depression. Like, these events happen. It's not like they can't happen again. Like, they're probably going to happen again. They'll probably happen more frequently and bigger. Most people are just blissfully unaware of how the whole thing works and how broken it is. But it really is a simpler world. Create more than you consume. Constantly be working to upskill yourself, right? How do I deliver more value to the world? That's going to bring more abundance to my family, to myself. It's also going to, you know, allow me to contribute more to the world. That's like what you get. In an honest system, the more you help the world, the more money you make. In a dishonest system, the more you cheat, the more money you make. It's a super weird distortion of incentives. So make more than you consume. Keep working to be able to give more to the world. Study money. Save in sound money. Save in Bitcoin. And if you have time bandwidth left, if trying to make a bit more money is more important than marginally spending a couple more hours with your kids, then invest. But does that align with your values? And even as I'm saying that, it's making me revise that in my own, you know, like, I think part of my job as a head of household is to spend some of my time investing, because that might make me more per unit of time and give me more time with my daughter. Maybe I'm just trying to justify it to myself right now. But I think I don't think anyone should be forced to invest. I think most people shouldn't invest. I think investing is still going to live and has a place, and I actually think it's an interesting realm to look into. I'm in that world, so I'm biased. But the important thing is it's optional. You don't have to do number three. Most people shouldn't do number th or sorry, number four. Most people shouldn't invest. That's just the reality of it. They'd be better off. And I don't know if you couldn't actually say that in a pre-Bitcoin world, because if you didn't invest, you got poor really quickly, right? And so it's kind of nice now. And the last thing I'll say is, if all you did for the past 10 years was buy Bitcoin, you outperformed the best hedge fund managers on earth that get paid to professionally manage money. Fact. Look up the receipt on that. If you don't believe me, I don't think you should believe me. I think you should look it up. Over the past 10 years, the compound annual growth rate of Bitcoin has earned significantly more money than any mutual fund, than any hedge fund manager, than even Warren Buffett. So even the best people who do it professionally, who are the best in the world, are making less than Bitcoin on a compound annual growth basis. So maybe Bitcoin's just an ego test. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think I forget where I've heard this too, like in terms of, 'cause another big thing that someone who's 16 or 18, like someone's coming into the world as an adult, needs to think about is work. And this is like, this will probably be an outdated take on that in a few short years, but work's obviously challenging. I don't know enough about the AI thing to really weigh in on that, but my general kind of intuition is like, just like there is a financialization of jobs that incentivizes people looking for meaning in their lives to work bullshit jobs. And it's really sad. Like I was hearing, fundamentals, he's talking about, as someone from a different podcast there from Rock Paper Bitcoin, talking about how his daughter's going through university to do schooling and he doesn't want her to work for the enemy. It's like these people, like brilliant minds coming out of the best universities in the world. I mean, maybe I'll throw air quotes around the best universities in the world, but for some of them, but they are nonetheless brilliant and they're going to work completely bullshit jobs that serve only to get them and the company they work for closer to the money printer, or to basically exploit this infinite, quote unquote, infinite money glitch in our available to people that can get closer to the money printer. And I don't know. I wouldn't get metaphysical about it, but I've been in a job that I consider a bullshit job on a number of levels that shouldn't be. Won't get into that, but it really sucks the life out of you doing those things. And so if I'm offering advice to my 16-year-old son, is an electrician is providing infinitely more value, making considerably less money than some hedge fund manager that's printing shares out of nothing and robbing the public blind. And you will feel that in your heart. So find, yeah, I mean, just find something that provides value for people. Find something that you could not survive with. Find a job that would survive were sound money to take over the world. And I think you're probably going to find a pretty morally uncomplicated job if you do that.
That's great advice. Yeah, never work, never choose certain work because of the money. Choose work that brings meaning to your life and delivers real, tangible value to real people. And there's always, I often I don't do it so much anymore, but I used to ask people all the time, like, if you, one of my favorite questions is how much money you need to make a week to live the life that you want to live right now. That always gets people because they're like, most people haven't even thought about that, right? How much money do you need to make to live a life you're happy with? You start there. And then a second parallel question, what do you love to do? What do you love to do? And if you can find the overlap of whatever you love to do that gives value to the world, that makes you enough money to live the life you want to live, that coalescence, like whatever Venn diagram element you land on with that, it's like start there. It's not to say that you're gonna do that for the rest of your life, but whatever you can do that you enjoy doing that feels more like play than work, that delivers value, and that can make you enough income to live the life that you want to live. And if your answer to the question of how much money do you need per week is more, then you're probably in for a pretty rude awakening and some pain. Because that just means, I think a lot of people idolize money, idolize fiat lifestyles, fancy cars, private jets, luxury items, like all these things that we've essentially been sort of programmed, for lack of a better word, to idolize and to revere and to look up to and to strive towards, is sort of like this weird story that doesn't usually result in happiness, even if you had obtained those things. So it's like, be super clear. If I'm talking to my 16-year-old daughter, it's like, be super clear on what kind of life you want to live. Find something you love to do that can generate value to other people, that can make you enough money to live. And spend lots of time thinking about what you want. Because if you don't spend time thinking about what you want and why you want that, it might have been someone else telling you that you want that. It might not actually be what you want. And if someone else told you what to want, it's not actually what you want. You can get what you want and still be super unhappy because you wanted the wrong things. So it's a deep question. But it's also super simple, right? It's like do something that brings you meaning, that makes you enough money to live the life you want to live, and be clear on what kind of life you want to live and what matters most to you.
Yeah, oftentimes I think too, even just finding something that you're good at, can generate that passion for what you do. There's probably certain dials to turn in terms of how challenging that work is based on your kind of spacing the word, but on how you feel about challenge, I guess. Like if you want something that's very hard to do, then you'll probably need to adjust what you're going to do. I think there's part of this too, and I would never claim to know any sort of timeline for these things. It could be 100 years, it could be 5 years. But I think that along with this financialization of jobs, like we're telling you, like don't do a bullshit job. There's a book called Bullshit Jobs, I think. I'm pretty sure I have not read it. How it's in the long list of books that I recommend on the podcast that I haven't read, but
How
I
can you recommend
think,
them if you haven't read them?
no, I can't say that I do. However, I know the principle of bullshit jobs. Think of just, a 9-to-1 admin to provider ratio in hospitals, say, or these sorts of things. Like,
Seems like a self-explanatory title.
Yeah,
We
and so.
all know what bullshit jobs are, whether we,
Yeah,
I feel like
totally.
we've all identified that, potentially done them, or can easily identify them and be like, that's a bullshit job. Nothing meaningful is being done there, and that person's being paid a lot of money. Ironically, that's most government jobs are bullshit jobs.
Yes, absolutely. And like, not only are they not good for you to do, in my opinion, and I don't think that there's something to strive for the kind of practical reasons that we talked about earlier, but I think they're going to die. Like, I think those jobs will die eventually. I think it's mathematical on some level. Again, I don't know the timeline for this, but when part of what people crave when they're going out, flying the coop or whatever, flying the nest, I don't know. They're craving security, and they're craving something in between an exciting job, but one that's going to keep them engaged, but also one that's going to keep them employed and have enough money to survive and everything. And I just can't see these useless jobs that everyone sees as useless, in a sound money world, surviving the transition, I think the inevitable transition to sound money. Yeah, it's hard to imagine that happening.
I agree. I look forward to the day where bullshit jobs don't exist. It's better for everyone, even the people who are doing bullshit jobs right now, will have a better life when they're. It might sound weird, and in the short term, they may be suffering, right? You have a bullshit job, great. You get fired, not so great. And you just unlocked your soul to do rewarding work. It's like that's the silver lining. It might be a hard pill to swallow initially. The reality is those jobs shouldn't exist and won't exist because in a sound money world, the only way you're going to survive is if you generate real value. And if you're not generating real value, you're not going to be able to afford to be paid. You know, like I literally think it does. When you get out of this manipulated money, you get rid of manipulated incentives that allow for those bullshit jobs to even exist. And so, yeah, from a pragmatic principle for our kids, it's like do things that bring you meaning, do work that brings you meaning in your life. And I like that point that you said, where it's like in at the moment where you're about to take off and be more independent, maybe just doing something you're good at as a means to make money to have that independence is a short-term bridge to being able to do the thing that you absolutely love and are stoked to do. Like I did landscaping for a year when I was younger, and I had zero energy to do anything else the entire summer. I realized that's really energy intensive work and it doesn't pay that much. I'm not going to do that again. So I did it. You know, sometimes you have to try things and just see what real work is and see what real value for your time is to really have a respect for the money you earn and not waste it. I think that's an important lesson as well. But I think by studying money, here's the thing, those principles for our 16-year-old kids, if they study money, if they do it sequentially, if they study money and adopt sound money, the pressure to do things to earn money goes down because the money you earned doesn't degrade. And so you have, I think our kids, if I look, try and look into the future, I see our kids working way less, like maybe working 20 hours a week, doing 10 hours of things they love, hobbies, recreation, whatever, and living a really good life, without the burden of constantly having to work and do more to earn less. Like it's just such a better world that they're going to grow up in. You know, like our kids are never going to, well, my daughter's the youngest. So as a 2-year-old, she's never going to know what banking hours are. She's never going to have a bank account where someone else can tell her what she can and can't do with her money. Like it's just going to be a different world. And yeah, I think that probably, I mean, the only other things that I had just as brief mentions were just sort of these quick principles of beware of debt. If you're going to have liabilities, things that, you know, different forms of debt. Not all debt is bad, but you have to be very careful with debt and you have to be aware and be very wise with whatever debt you take on. But if you're going to have debt, have that debt denominated in fiat currency, and have your assets denominated in Bitcoin. And if you take that sort of strategy from a broad level, assets in Bitcoin, liabilities in fiat, it's going to serve you really well. And I think the only other thing is, there's a saying that money is the root of all evil. That's like a pretty pervasive saying. A lot of people frankly feel that. But I think it's wrong. I think fiat money is the root of all evil. Money is not the root of all evil. Money is just a tool to store our time and do good in the world. And so, you know, if you don't want to make a lot of money, and money is a proxy for the value you bring to the world. You've pre-decided to not give very much value, to give less value to the world, right? I think you want people giving a lot of value and doing good in the world to have a lot of money, right? I think there's this, you don't want to glorify money, in a monetary system where you get paid to cheat, it you don't want to even want money because most people get there by cheating the hardest, right? So it's like this really big tainting of this fundamental notion of the more value I give to the world, the more IOUs the world gives me to do other things with, which is just money, tokens for our time. And so money isn't the root of all evil. Fiat money is the root of all evil, and you can opt out of that evil system and just operate in a system of truth. And so, I don't know what kind of world they're gonna live in, but a wise message from the future might be, don't be lured in by fiat promises, because they will still be present probably when they're older. They'll always promise something for nothing, and stay grounded in truth, and don't live beyond your means. That's like almost the really big one, is like live within or ideally below your means, meaning spend less than you make. That means you're living a profitable life, and in it's like you're either in one of two modes basically as a human. You're either taking from society or you're adding to society. If you're in a surplus, you are living a profitable life. If you are in debt, you're living a bankrupt life where you are going deeper and deeper into time debt by living off of what others create, because you're not able to create more than you consume yourself. So that's all I had to say. I think that,
Yeah.
yeah, go ahead.
It's like, and fiat impairs that so much. Like, there's people that living the exact same life, spending the same amount of money, doing the same amount of things, will just over time become less and less able to accomplish that. And living within their means becomes harder and harder over time. And so when you use sound money, that effect goes away. It actually inverses. So like the you can chart you can actually end up charging less for things. It's kind of maybe it's a bit of a tangent, but like if you're saving in sound money and you have a long time preference and you have, savings and these things, you can actually all sorts of fun things happen to the economics of providing value for people. That's super interesting. That is absolutely not the case with monopoly money. So, yeah.
All right, it's a good place to wrap up. Kids, we hope that was useful. I think we'll probably do another one before they're 16. So we have a couple cracks to
Probably.
polish this. But whatever, we can give them our first rep. And hopefully, if you're listening to this, something in there is valuable to you. Thank you for listening. If you know someone who's ready to hear this or can benefit from hearing this, please send it to them. Check out endinflationcanada.com if you're Canadian and you want to end the fraud of fiat inflation. And yeah, study money, take care of yourself, opt into freedom money. And Luke's and I will be back in a week for the next episode. Thanks for being here.
See ya.